Hey everyone, John Wirth, I'm here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast, a Wimbledon recap week. We are going to talk about the championships, 2018 Wimbledon, the reemergence of Novak Djokovic, less dramatically, but just as impressively, the reemergence of Angie Kerber, why we still love Serena and Rafa Nadal, other storylines that may have been lost in the folds. Jamie Lasanti is going to join us for a 45-minute session on Wimbledon 2018. All right, Jamie, nice to see you.
Welcome back.
Hey, thanks. You can see by these driver's side and dual side airbags under my eyes that we're fighting the jet lag beast a little bit. Actually, it's not that bad coming this direction. But anyway, you were not at Wimbledon. You did great work on our Fashionable 50 issue, as you do every year. Unfortunately, this caused you to miss the tennis. And I am curious. We can go through all sorts of topics. We can take this in any of 100 directions. But top line thoughts from watching this on TV stateside.
Yeah, so I got to watch as much as I could. I was flying during the men's semis, but
which one?
I was flying during the Anderson Isner match. I got off the plane, turned on my phone, and I couldn't look at it for 2 minutes because I had so many messages and there were so many tweets and everything.
Because your social circle was so wrapped watching a 26-24 fifth set. I was going to say, if you were flying during Rafa Novak, I would have been empathetic and said, boy, you should have taken a connection through Denver and stayed and watched at the airport bar. If you were flying during Anderson Isner, I commend you on your travel plans.
Yeah, so that's the only thing I really didn't watch. But I just said to you, I am surprised that Djokovic won. Like, I guess I can eat my words because I sat here 2 weeks ago and I said that I didn't think that he would win a few matches and then suddenly rise back up. But he suddenly got back to the top. And I mean,
he's a great returner, Jamie. It's one of those things where we see evidence of this so often in tennis. And I'm reading about the Baltimore Orioles, and they need a few rebuilding seasons, and they've got to get bad before they get good. And the Kansas City Royals, it's going to take a while to turn this thing around. In tennis, it doesn't take long to turn it around. You are crazy for writing off players, because this is what happens. You have your confidence. I mean, I saw Novak Djokovic lose in Indian Wells to Taro Daniel in a match where he did not look engaged. He didn't look like he wanted to be there. He didn't look like he had anything resembling an aura. He lost to Benoit Paire in Miami. And then, you know, gradually put it together.
But I think you look at Serena at Indian Wells, and you could say the same thing. I mean, she barely was playing tennis, you know, then. Like, she was just coming up. But her situation is completely different than Djokovic. And so I think that's what makes his, like, remarkable rise in these 2 weeks so surprising. I mean, he literally went from not being able to win a title, not winning a major since the 2016 French Open, and then all of a sudden he has another major. I mean,
it's these are champions. Novak Djokovic had a much easier pregnancy than Serena Williams. But I think it just confidence begets confidence, and a couple of things go your way. And, you know, I mean, we can nitpick and say, who did Djokovic really have to beat? Well, he had one tremendous win over Rafa. Great match. I mean, you could go back, and he had the good fortune of making it an indoor match. Remind me to tell you a theory I have about that. But, you know, and then all of a sudden, I can win this thing. This is lining up nicely to me, and I get a tired Kevin Anderson opponent who, even under equal footing without a long match, is probably a, you know, 75-25, 80-20 Djokovic, especially in best of five sets. And all of a sudden, you're back on the board. And I still think a few things. One of them is that semifinal with Nadal. If Nadal wins that match, and he had break points in the fifth, I mean, he was right there. It was a well-played match. Nadal had one running forehand that he missed by about 6 inches. If Nadal wins that match, he probably wins the final, safe to say. Rematch of the U.S. Open, tired Kevin Anderson. I mean, 80-20. All of a sudden, Nadal's got 18 majors. He's won the French and Wimbledon, so he's pulled off the channel double. He's within two of Federer. He's, as we all know, he is almost 5 years younger than Federer. We're having a very, very different conversation. And we're talking about a forehand on the run that missed by 18 inches. Instead, the conversation suddenly becomes Djokovic is back, and he's the youngest of the big four, 31 years old. He has 13 now. Is he the favorite at the U.S. Open? Has he found his game again? I still think...
That was my question. I was going to ask you. I had two questions. One is, what does this mean for the U.S. Open and the summer hard court season? Do you think that this has now flipped the switch?
It's really
set the fire
it's
off.
A great
he's,
question. I mean,
he's
he,
gone, or is this going to be another? Is this just a step up and sort of like a climbing uphill battle for him to get back?
I think he's here, and I do think that, you know, ask me after Cincinnati. I mean, I think these Nadal is a defending champion again. Nadal wins that indoor match, and it's a completely different storyline. And we're talking about how Djokovic is getting closer, but maybe he's still lacking that something. Remember, at Queen's Club, 2 weeks before Wimbledon, he had match points and couldn't close the door on Marin Cilic. So this Wimbledon, it was sort of what's the old line about going broke, sort of suddenly and then quickly. I think right now, though, I mean, certainly Nadal, Federer, Djokovic pick. Those are your three U.S. Open favorites. This was a remarkable comeback by Djokovic. I mean, I think there's still some questions that he probably has to answer, both to himself and more generally. But no, I mean, he's back. The conversation has sort of veered in a very, I mean, again, if he said Novak Djokovic is going to win Wimbledon, people, I don't think they would have looked at you crazy, but I think they would have said, you know, that may be a little too fast. Things are trending in the right direction. Right. It wasn't like he totally came from, I mean, he'd been playing better.
No, like you said.
The French Open was fluky.
And on grass, too, which actually probably.
You know, he's a four-time champion. I mean, you know, he's won this thing twice as many times as Nadal has. But all of a sudden, the tennis story in the men's game is it's gone in a very different direction. And yet, we're still talking about big three. We're still talking about, I mean, in some ways, you know, Zverev and Nick Kyrgios are still question marks. In some ways, this is very much a continuation of the conversation. But this is a new plot. And I commend Djokovic. I mean, he's been through a lot in terms of injuries. I think at some point, and it's one of these, if we're going to talk candidly, we all dance around what the hell's happened over the last 2 years. And he himself has had sort of vague references to personal issues. And I think that's largely his explanation to give and his story to tell. And I think there's an element of privacy that needs to be respected. I mean, he went, just for perspective, though, I mean, he went from winning 11 of 22 majors, as you say, culminating with the 2016 French Open career slam, 11 of 22 majors won, to struggling to reach week twos. So,
and not winning other titles.
Yeah, he didn't want to. Before Wimbledon, he got a year without winning a title. Exactly.
Losing
exactly.
First round matches that he should not
Martin
have been
Clijon,
losing.
Exactly.
I mean, and so that, yeah, that's what I mean. We sat here many times and talked about what the hell is going on, because it
Jamie.
Is clearly yeah. mystifying. And I mean, you were waiting for something to happen. And I don't know, do you think something happened, like you said, that we don't really know about in his personal life? Or do you think it was just sort of confidence thing, as you said, all the pieces fell into place and all of a sudden?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can say, how are we going to dance around this? But the level of engagement by his entourage appeared to be more intense at Wimbledon than it's been at previous majors. It does seem like he's in a good space personally. I don't want to discount this. I mean, we saw him serve in Australia and it was clear this elbow injury was no joke. I don't want to completely discount
injuries
here. But yeah, we've seen this before. We've seen it with Serena Williams. We saw Pete Sampras, you know, humiliated at Wimbledon 2002. And then he collects himself and he's a great player and he can draw on confidence of having won double-digit majors, all of which Djokovic did. And suddenly he's won the U.S. Open in 2002. I mean, we've seen this so many times. It doesn't take that much for a champion to find their mojo again. I hate the word mojo. But it does not take long for champions to be reacquainted with their past. And also, I mean, you can't underestimate what it means in terms of confidence to know you've done this before. That's what we were saying. That's one reason I was so surprised by Simona Halep, which is a bit of a digression. But once you've proven yourself you can win one of these, that's a big deal. But anyway, I mean, here we are, and Novak Djokovic is defending nothing the rest of the year. So
I'm excited to see if this... We can like look back, 2 years ago we were like peak Djokovic time, right? It seemed like he not gonna ever be kind of pushed off, and then now two years later we're here, and now this is sort of, I'm curious to see if this will be kind of a big turning point. Are we gonna look back and say, you know, this is where he started part two of his career, where he really surged and kind of continued to win all these majors and do all these things. Because we, even people like Serena, have had times in their career, as you said, that they've fallen off and kind of struggled, and then all of a sudden they rise back up.
We forget Federer went, you know, from 2012 Wimbledon, which he won, didn't win a gold medal. He didn't win another major until 2017 Australian Open. I mean, Roger Federer went almost 5 years without winning a major. All right, so let me ask you two questions. A, what is more likely? This is like Tennis Channel green room chatter. What's more likely, Nadal catching Federer or Djokovic catching Nadal?
Nadal catching Federer.
More likely.
More likely in terms of like recency or just generally? Like,
no, just
more likely to happen soon or more likely? I was thinking more likely to happen
soon.
Oh,
who's going to first? Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm
what's
again,
your...
I think I agree with you. And I think, you know, does Nadal have 2017 right now? Does Nadal have some more French Opens? And absolutely. I mean, 2017 French Open, Nadal was virtually untouchable. At age 32, he still got it, especially on clay. I think this Djokovic question becomes very interesting all of a sudden. And again, I mean, we never counted him out, which I just think is foolish. And I think it's
no, but there was
something entirely
definitely...
too harsh. But I definitely think there was a question of, boy, what's right. going on there, and when's he going to figure out this riddle? All right, so here's the second question. Djokovic, we know one thing about him, and I think this is admirable. I don't think this is at all a knock against him, but this is somebody who wants to be liked. He doesn't just want to be respected. Sort of affection means something to him. And that's, I got no problem with that. If he says on Saturday morning, you know what, it will probably work to my detriment, but this is an outdoor tournament. It's a glorious Saturday in Great Britain. Wimbledon has such a history of these fine outdoor matches. And environmentally, it's really silly to air condition an indoor 15,000 fan stadium on a day like this. It may work to my detriment, but I'm with Rafa. Let's take the roof off and play an outdoor match. I would think he would claw back considerable goodwill, and that would go down as a real sporting gesture. I don't think he was obligated to do it by any sense. That would have been completely voluntary. I don't think he did anything wrong by not doing that. But for someone who likes to be liked, don't you think that would have helped redefine him a little bit? And I'll tell you what, people I said that to said, are you crazy? He's trying to win a match. Don't be ridiculous. Like, he's not here to make friends. He's here to win trophies, which he did. But
right.
It did occur to me he had an opportunity for considerable goodwill. You want to pick that apart?
No.
All right.
I get it. I get both sides. My reaction was kind of going to be the same. Like, you're a competitor first. So I think, especially someone like him, that's your first, it's the first thing you go to.
Spoken like the former athlete you were. I just thought, I think this was a good tournament overall for Djokovic. I mean, he's got to be thrilled first and foremost with the result. He has to be thrilled to have played that kind of a match. I mean, the final, we all know, was a bit of an anticlimax.
Right.
But I thought that Djokovic should be very happy with how these 2 weeks go. I mean, the match against Nadal was an instant classic. He had a couple of sort of churlish, and I thought kind of silly, honestly, outburst with the crowd. The center court crowd, you're up 2-1. You don't need to get into it with them. But I did think overall he came off very well. The moment with his son was really adorable. And
very cute.
Obviously, he cares more and should care more about winning majors than anything else, which he did. But I do think from a public relations standpoint, it was a nice tournament for him as well.
Very, very cute child.
What else? You want to go to women or you want to talk men? What else do we have on men? I'll tell you two stories lost in the shuffle.
Yes.
Three stories.
This is the stuff I like to hear about.
So, I think Mike Bryan winning a major in doubles at age 40 without his brother. And Mike is, his brother's injured. Mike's been through a lot. And picking on Jack Sock, which is interesting. Jack Sock's a terrific doubles player. I mean, Jack Sock's fan. And this wasn't
Jack
his first
Sock
title.
Jack Sock is a terrific doubles player who's had a horrific year as a singles player.
I was thinking, like, Kansas City Royals horrific. No, Jack Sock's had a really rough year in a lot of ways. And
is good for him.
Yeah, you talk about someone whose sort of popularity has room to grow. He's it's been a rough year in a lot of ways for Jack Sock. So, no, you hope that this might kickstart his singles career. It's nice to, I mean, he lost in the first round to a qualifier. I don't know. God knows what he's going to be ranked if he doesn't defend these points in the fall. I mean, here's someone who made London last year, won a Masters 1000, and he's just, right. I think he's won five matches on the year. I mean, he's just an absolute non-entity in singles, and he's can't go a match without having some unfortunate exchange with fans or the chair or the opponent's coach in this case. To think that he leaves as A, a Wimbledon champion, B, considerably wealthier. He does, you know, he gets a nice chunk of change from the USTA, so it probably isn't hurt. But it's nice to leave a major as a trophy winner on the last Sunday. He also played mixed doubles with Sloane Stephens. So my takeaway from this was a lot about Mike, great for Mike Bryan, one of the all-time good guys. A little strange that he and his brother no longer have the same total of majors won. But Jack Sock was one of my takeaways, too, who's really just an unbelievable doubles player. And it's very hard to play doubles and singles. But
interesting. I wonder if this helps him, gives him confidence, as you say, walk away from a major with a trophy after kind of a terrible year. Or if it kind of is a little concerning and you're like, well, you know.
Maybe I ought to be a double special. I don't, you know, it's funny too because his singles game brings to bear so few of his double skills. I mean, he's kind of a serve and a forehand, you know, typical kind of up the guts, serve and a forehand singles player. There's a lot of nuance to his doubles. He's great around the net. He's a good athlete. I mean, he had some overheads from behind the baseline. I mean, it's really fun to watch him play doubles, and you never would necessarily guess that. You don't get to see, I mean, he doesn't show off his hands much in a singles match. But anyway, I also think, you want to know another underrated story? Was the junior champion. They played the boys' final that actually, I think they were still playing when the men took the court, so this was really lost in the folds. He played a British player, Robert Draper's son, who, I was calling him Don Draper. They played on court one, so it was a huge crowd. But Seng Chun Sin of Taiwan, we will not say, what's the Olympic designation? Chinese Taipei? We will not do that. But from Taiwan, he should have won and was right there in the final with Sebastian Corda at Australian Open, was a finalist there, won the French Open, won Wimbledon. Usually a single major title doesn't necessarily serve as a great predictor for majors for successes as a full-time pro, but you get to three straight junior finals and win two of them. Go back and look at players who have done that. Guy Amon Fils is an example. That tends to augur success. So this is a player to watch, and having a player from Taiwan as one of the sport's great promising prospects, I think is really intriguing. I think that's a story to follow. The other thing, I mean, this Roger Uniglow, I don't know how that played with. We talked about it a little bit before the tournament.
Right.
There was a question, was this just a stalking horse offer? Was this done just to sort of get Nike's attention, or was he really going to make the move? And it turns out he did. As editor of Fashionable 50, I thought you would be singularly well-positioned to riff on this. What do you think of Uniqlo and Roger?
So first of all, very shocking when first saw everything. Right? It was a little very jarring for me. Also, I just thought he was going to win. So I immediately go to the superstitious luck side. He wasn't wearing his good old Nike clothes. That's the reason why. But that's totally not true, obviously. I thought it was interesting the point you made in your 50 thoughts. Like, we all kind of joked that this was a big deal. It was very seismic just because of what he's been wearing for so long. But honestly, it's the nature of the business and that side of sports, sponsorships and sponsors and things like that. That's kind of how things work. But I don't know. I go back. I was talking about this with someone, and they had mentioned the Steph Curry Under Armour Nike thing from back when kind of Nike really fudged that whole thing with them, with Steph. So it was interesting to think about it from that perspective. It was with someone who really doesn't follow tennis, and they just thought of it as a transactional type thing with sports. Right. So, I don't know. It's a little sad.
You're sad to see the, you know, the now that we no longer have to wonder what's going to become of Novak Djokovic, do you wonder what's going to become the RF logo?
Yes.
All right. I thought the whole way it was done was strange.
Well, because there was no, we were left guessing for
right. Well, you know,
weeks.
He practiced in Nike before his first match, and then there was sort of this 20-minute window, and this whole team kind of changed into Uniqlo. It struck me as
it was weird,
a little strange, a little cloak and dagger. It didn't strike me as sort of a Federer type of MO. It's not really his MO.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I understand it from Nike's standpoint, and they've got P&L statements, and they've got data on 36-year-old athletes, and I get it, and I understand it from Roger's position, and I guess, you know, clothes are kind of one of those blind spot with me. You know, people that cover the sport have different, some people are great with X's and O's and don't care about the agency and the business side, and some people, the attire thing, I never really get into too much unless it's, you know, appalling.
I would be curious.
The Adidas zebra stripes come to mind. What were you going to say?
I would be curious about the actual, like, quality of the gear itself. I mean, I know that there are obviously tons of players have played in Nike stuff and never played in Uniqlo gear, but I know, like, soccer-wise, there was a difference between Adidas and Nike for certain things. You know, some people liked Nike socks versus Adidas socks, or especially for cleats, different things like that, you know, fits person A's feet better than person B. So I'm curious, you know, like, I know comfort has to be a thing for players and, you know, how you feel when you're playing, but
maybe it's like maybe it's a stencil job. No, I think the one thing about Roger that I just thought was interesting was his whole brand is predicated on sort of elegance and luxury, and I don't want to say elitism, but there's a certain sort of rarefied air in the brands and Rolex and Mercedes and
for sure,
you know, Swiss coffee makers. And I mean, I do think, you know, Uniqlo is, God bless it, I would never disparage a brand, but this is where, like, my wife and I buy our kids clothes before they go to camp. I mean, this is not.
They're amazing for
upmarket. Yeah, it's great.
$20 sweatpants and some nice fleece and everything else.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You go with your camp shopping list, but this is not.
And not like Nike is.
You don't wear that with a Rolex.
And it's not like Nike is considered a luxury brand either, but there is a certain way that
the way they
present it presents itself. Exactly.
The logo. And,
the logo and just even how they.
Do you remember
the marketing materials around them?
Yeah, and the cream cardigan. And
Nike has also been very fashion forward with their athletes, and so that's something that Federer has always it relates to the Rolexes and the whatever.
My kids ain't wearing Rolexes with their Uniqlo apparel. Anyway, I feel like we've done what tennis has done to its great detriment this year. I mean, you know what that is?
What?
Give second class status to the women. I think this has been a great
fault,
season.
I
blame you, Jamie Lasanti. No, let's talk women's tennis, because I think I have a can I give you a little riff here?
Yes.
I think, first of all, it's really foolish to compare the men to the women. And, the women lost 10 seeds in the first 8 days, and the men only lost two. And Rafa, Roger, and Novak now are so reliable, and the women are kind of Serena and win, lose, or draw. I think men's tennis and women's tennis play really well together. I think they play off each other really well. I think if you like unpredictability and you like upsets, great. If you want reliable champions, you got that too. But I think these women's matches, and I think, you know, again, obviously the draw from a seeding standpoint was ravaged. I think some of that was a little bit overlooked. I mean, I don't think Makarova beating Carolyn Wozniacki on grass is quite the upset that the seeds would have you believe it is. But what do we get in the end? We got two Hall of Famers. We have two players who have now played in, I think it's three of the last six majors that they've both entered. They've played each other in the final, obviously talking about Kerber and Serena. Kerber had already beaten Serena on a fast court in Australia in 2006. They had a great Wimbledon final in 2006. They meet again. Not a great final, but I think women's tennis has done awfully well for itself. And I think too often it's men versus women, and we don't think about the mosaic of tennis and sort of as an entity. I think men's and women's tennis really play off of each other well. I also would say that, you know, the top four women now in the rankings, each of them has won a major. We had the same thing at the French Open. Kerber now moving up into to a top four ranking. Great to see Serena back. I think one takeaway is tennis still really matters to her. Mm-hmm. I think in a weird way, it probably helps that she didn't win. She came close. She's motivated. She knows she can still play a lot of great tennis. She can still serve in the 120s. There's some aspects of her game that still understandably need a little bit of fine tuning. But I think in a way, tennis benefited from Serena's not winning, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I love the women's tournament, and I always love women's tennis, but I feel like this has been a great year for women's tennis, and I wish this were perceived a little different by the tennis community, and I wish that maybe the WTA did a better job of spinning this. I think this one line about kind of like the field is so deep rings a little bit hollow. I think there were too many losses, Madison Keys, Halep, Muguruza, too many of those matches were Kvitova losing the last set 6-0. It wasn't as though Radina, who beat Madison Keys, then like went on this tear and we all said, oh boy, right, she's a player. I mean, I think it's a little disingenuous to simply stop at saying the field is so deep, anyone can beat anyone. But I think the women's product is quite strong, and I thought it again at this tournament.
For sure.
Rant over.
Yeah. No, I agree. You said 2006, but you meant 2016.
I'm sorry.
And no, but I was going to say that it felt like this tournament felt like 2016 all over again, between Djokovic winning, and then we had Kerber Serena, which was kind of the big storyline of 2016. It was so nice to see. I really thought Serena was going to do it, but I understand your point about it being good for tennis and good for her as well. I think she definitely started to feel the moment at the end.
Yeah, didn't you? Did that come across on TV?
It did, for sure. She has this like tendency where she does like one of two things, where she does her, when it starts getting intense, she really like, she does that bounce from side to side, and you can like see it in her face where she's like locked in and ready to go.
Right.
And then sometimes she has that really nervous look on her face. And sometimes the nervousness honestly doesn't mean anything. She'll overcome it, and she's won matches where she's dropped sets because maybe she came out a little off or something like that. But I did see that a little bit, where you sort of saw her maybe going, oh wow, I'm gonna win Wimbledon, you know. And
I feel like some of this was the build up, and Tiger Woods is there and Chandra Rhyme. I mean, just right. You know, the another blind spot besides attire. I'm terrible with
Meghan
the Royals.
Markle.
The Royals. Yeah, I know Meghan Markle. But right. So you had Kate and Meghan Markle are there, and the players box is filled with these A-listers. And I think even before the match started, the moment got to her a little bit. And yeah, I think like Federer, she played nervous.
Yeah.
And you could really see it. You could see it in her body language. You could see it. I mean, she was missing shots that she wouldn't miss in the first six rounds. She
wouldn't come close
to missing.
That was weird about Federer.
I think the same thing with Federer.
Yeah. It's, it's good, though. It's nice to see her. I think also part of it is that she's really embraced this role as, like, a role model for mothers, and kind of really, she's really embraced being a mother, not just with, obviously, at home, but I think she's really taken to saying, you know, this is how I'm dealing with this. This is how I'm dealing with being a mother and an athlete. And I think it's great. I think it's really admirable. I love that she's...
I think it's authentic, too. I mean, I think we've seen this. But I feel like one of the great cliche tropes in sports are something happens and what do we say? It's given them perspective. They used to be clueless, but then, you know, their sister had leukemia and it's given them perspective. But
right.
I really felt like this was a different Serena Williams. She conducted herself differently. Go back and look at the text and the syntax of her press conferences, the seven press conferences, eight, I guess, she gave at Wimbledon versus a year ago, 5 years ago. That sounds like a different person who's approaching life differently. She's obviously, and I think some of this pregnancy is, some of this sort of maternity leave, this return is about, some of it's a physical story, and what does it take to get your body back to being an elite athlete? And we talked about her movement isn't quite there, but her serve is, and the pec muscle. I think a lot of this is just emotional.
Agreed. Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. But I think she's fallen into this role, but I think it's something she's not used to. And she wants to be that voice, because I think she feels like she really loves being a mother, and she wants to share that with people and kind of embrace it. But I think she's also kind of still figuring it out and finding her way in that. So I think there is just an extra amount of pressure. I mean, when she won her other majors, she wasn't also a role model for all these mothers, you know, like you said, getting their body back and dealing with a baby at home and dealing with all these things. And now she's not only trying to win more Grand Slams, but she's also kind of embracing this role. So that was interesting.
No, and I think one of the great, I've said this before, but I think one of the best parts of this whole Williams family story is that we always play this game, and well, we didn't know what we had until it was gone, and I wish we would appreciate him more. Some of this is just a function of how long they both played, but these are not polarizing figures, Venus and Serena. These are not figures where you take sides and they're good. I mean, I think Serena's pretty much universally revered these days. And the people who don't like her, what do they point to? Well, she once screamed at a line judge and threatened her. And that is correct. That's regrettable. I would say that was in the heat of battle. I always draw this demarcation. I would also say that was almost a decade ago.
Right.
Is there no statute of limitation? Like, that's what you hold against Serena Williams, that in 2009 she had
a... What did you do a decade ago
exactly. Probably
wasn't so great?
No, I think one of the... I always say this. This Williams story is one of the great sports stories of our time, no matter how much we've heard it. But one of the nicest parts to me is that they have embraced tennis. Tennis has embraced them. Going beyond that, these are not polarizing figures. I think they're completely appreciated. There is no sort of tepid applause when Serena Williams talks or takes the court. She is universally liked and adored, and she should be. So anyway, I think that it'll be interesting to see how she plays at the U.S. Open. She was right there. You know, Angie Kerber is a tricky opponent. Playing a left-hander is never easy. The court is chewed up, which probably helped Kerber all the more. I do think the moment got to Serena a little bit, but she ought to. She does not leave with a 24th title, but she leaves with everything else she possibly could have wanted out of that tournament. Other points of business. Apart from, I'll spare you my 30 seconds about my fondness for Daria Kazatkina. God, is she fun to watch. Strange tournament overall. I think if Nadal Djokovic had been the final and not the semi by quirk of draw, we're talking about this tournament very differently. Bit of an anticlimax. I feel like, all right, let's do it, Jamie. Let's have the obligatory riff on playing out these fifth sets, since you're not allowed to have a conversation about tennis this week without having an opinion here. Your thoughts?
Well, considering that I was on a plane, I didn't actually watch. So
it was a long flight. Six and a half hours. all right. Anyway,
I was coming from LA.
All right.
Anyway. I think that when we get to this point of in the 20s, it just becomes like ridiculous. I think we get, as we said earlier, we probably still get Djokovic as a champion on Sunday, but we probably get a better final on Sunday if Anderson is not so just wiped. I mean, it's crazy. At least I kind of compare it to the World Cup. You can have overtime matches in the World Cup. You can have PKs, and PKs are as emotionally draining as anything. But at least if from both sides of the draw, you have both teams that go through two rounds of overtime and then they go through penalties, they have the same. It's equal, right? I mean, you're always going to have it the same. So we don't have that in tennis here. And so I think that's what sort of makes it unfair to me, is that it does make it one-sided. And it's not about the tennis after a while.
Exactly. It also, I mean, I also think that the unfortunate thing, and this is just nature, there's no way around this, but this impacts more than just the two players. Someone said, well, shouldn't this be the punishment for not breaking serve? Like, why are we giving these guys an out? Like, break serve if you want to get this match over with. But I think that one of the unfortunate things about playing out these fifth sets is that it impacts everyone. So Nadal and Djokovic have to play an indoor match much later than they thought.
Right.
They have to come back, and we have the silly spectacle of the indoor match while it's a beautiful day. The women's final doesn't have a starting time. There was not one women's doubles match on center court because the schedule got mucked up. I mean, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, a match that goes 26-24 impacts everyone, TV, the fans, coverage, scheduling. So I think we can't just isolate it on the players. 10 seconds, by the way. Nicole Melichar, who I candidly did not know much about, finalist in women's doubles and won the mixed. Nice tournament for her. American player from Czech Republic. Actually, I'm looking at her bio here. I believe this is Lucy Safarova's hometown. But anyway, nice to see a player that most fans probably haven't heard too much about come away with such a successful tournament. But anyway, back to the point. Yeah, I think the consensus is you just need a finish line. And there's all sorts of social science on this, right? I mean, if someone says, go run 4 miles on a treadmill, you do it. And if they say, go run, okay, you got to run another half mile, your performance goes off a cliff. Why? Because mentally you've accounted for 4 miles being, if someone says swim to shore,
you have a destination.
You want to know where it is.
It's
if someone
why your trainer says, counts down from 10 to 9 and doesn't tell you, just keep going.
And you don't know how much of my energy should I expend. Am I going to be here till 26, 24? Should I go all out in this game? Right. I think athletes need, we all do, right? This is why deadlines are effective. We all need start times and finish times.
While we're here, though.
Lay it on me.
Let's give a little round of applause for Kevin Anderson. I think we didn't talk about him.
No,
but
you're
right.
It's,
I mean,
good point.
Finalist of the U.S. Open. Finalist here again at Wimbledon. In between that, he did fall off. He had some injuries, right?
Yeah, he had a rough go of it. I mean, not unlike John Isner. No, he's had a rough go of it this year.
But
and then pulled it together. Pros,
exactly. A guy we probably don't give enough credit to. So
I'll tell you too. His coach left him late last year.
Right. So he
went to go work for Young Chung. So Yeah, exactly. There's some distraction and some disruption with having.
So good
a coach
to see
change.
Him get back.
Good to see.
Up.
Kevin Anderson, that's two finals now in, remember we had Kelsey? Remember we had his wife on the podcast?
We did.
We should double back with her.
We should. She's great.
What's it like sitting in that box when your husband's playing for major titles now and beating Roger Federer and playing 26-24? It's quite a, I mean, I think some of this, we talk about how beat up Kevin Anderson was for the final. I think some of this is just emotionally beat up too.
Well,
you beat Federer in five sets, you come back, you win 26-24, then you play the Wimbledon final, you walk out there, center court, you know, the Duke and Duchess of Parsleyville are there. Royalty's not my thing. I think this guy hopefully is on a beach somewhere with no internet and just regrouping and recouping, because that's a busy 76 hours. But good play, Kevin Anderson. All right, that does it, Jamie. Andy Roddick, I believe, will be joining us next week. I will actually not be here, but maybe we'll pre-tape this. Otherwise, you've got the keys to the car. Pleasure talking tennis with you, Jamie.
It's great. I enjoyed it, as always.
As always. The fans want more Lasanti this week. They got it. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, as always, to Jamie, who not only starred in this podcast, but will now produce it and edit it, too. She is a versatile colleague. Keep the guest suggestions coming, and we will do this again in 7 days. Have a good week, everyone. And if people were so interested, Jamie, where could they listen to this podcast?
They can go on Apple Podcasts and sign up, subscribe, do all the things, and keep sending us recommendations.
A veritable Nicole Melichar you are. See how you picked that up? Good doubles player. All right, that does it for this week. Have a good week, everyone. We'll do it again in 7 days. We'll be right back.